Relatively Geeky presents the Ollie's Grab Bag Review episode. Ollie's Bargain Outlet is a chain of retail stores founded in 1982 with the slogan, Good Stuff Cheap. The stores deal in surplus merchandise obtained from various retailers, suppliers, or manufacturers, often via closeouts, bankruptcy sales, or other methods used to buy stock at below wholesale costs. As of November 2017, the chain had 268 locations in 20 states. In the middle of 2015, the store went public, meaning it joined a stock market, with an initial stock price of $16 per share. By the end of 2016, the share price had risen into the high 20s before spending 2017 on a very impressive run, far outpacing other companies in a struggling retail sector. And in a year that was very good to many stocks, 2017, Ollie's was exceedingly strong, more than doubling. By the start of March 2018, the stock had risen to nearly $60 per share. And over the first few months of 2018, Ollie's has become the talk of comic book social media, or at least my little section of it. Near as I can piece together, it was in early January of 2018 that Ollie's and DC Comics struck a deal, a big deal, for out-of-print and discontinued DC products, showcases, trades, etc. And Ollie's became stocked to the gills with DC merchandise. And people who were just regular shoppers of Ollie's started posting about the amazing deals to be had on this merchandise. Showcases in the $3 or $4 range. Trades at anywhere from $2 to $7 or $8. Amazing deals. Well below even the best graphic novel sales that I've seen in half-price books. I mean, Ollie's was selling this stuff dirt cheap. I had never gone to an Ollie's before. I suppose I had driven by one, because there are three in my general geographic region, but they just never made an impression. There was never any reason for me to go into one, until my buddy started posting pictures of the cheap DC materials, and a few Marvels also, that were available. So in short order, I visited the three locations of Ollie's that are here in the central Ohio area. Now, at one of those locations, it was really nothing very good. But at the other two, I bought a fair amount of stuff. Nothing like Christopher J. Wharton or some of the others who posted amazing hauls. I did get a couple of showcases, Elongated Man and The Phantom Stranger. I got a few trades that I'm not going to mention here, because they may end up as birthday presents for a certain Short Box Showcase and Darkness to Light co-host of mine. I actually bought some DC Kids books, easy reader chapter books, that will eventually find their way to my buddy Terry Colucci and his brood of boys. And another thing that I saw that they had at a couple of the locations was comic book grab bag. Now, this is separate from the big DC purchase, which somebody on social media reported as being something like 27 delivery trucks worth of material that got sent from the DC warehouse to Ollie's locations across the country. But one of the other things I saw there, not connected to the DC acquisitions, was comic book grab bags. Now, of course, since Quarterbin 100 last year, I kind of have a soft spot for comic book grab bags. And the ones at Ollie's were 10 books for $5.99. Obviously, for me, 60 cents is pretty darn expensive for a comic, especially when you remember that the grab bags of comics I did talk about last summer, Quarterbin 100, were 14 cents each. Now, other people have different pricing standards, so I thought I could do a public service by buying one of these Ollie's 10 packs, reviewing the books inside, and then leaving it up to you lovely listeners to decide if these are a good deal. Because like I say, once those DC showcases and trade collections are gone, these may well still be there. And I will be discussing these in what's come to be known as the Ben Avery system. I will talk about why I bought this specific pack, and then open it, do a brief overview of the books, and then go through them one at a time. And each time I read one, hop on here for a few minutes and talk about it. Now, when Ben does this over on the Comic Book Time Machine, he usually reviews 3 packs, so I think he does it in one sitting. Now, mine, I'm going to have to do over a couple of days, probably, because I have 10 books here. But that certainly is the inspiration for the format of this episode. And as is a fundamental concept in my employment in academia, if you give credit, it's not stealing. Now, here is the pack of comics. Can you hear that? It says, Comic Book Super Value Pack, a $20 value, 10 different comics, some PG-13. Well, here we go. Now, in terms of deciding which one of these packs to pick out of the maybe 60 or 70 that were in the store, it was as simple as trying to find one with at least 2 issues that looked interesting, because you have the front and the back. You can see 2 of the 10 comics, which again, compared to the 50 packs that I looked at last year at Quarterbin 100, with these, you do get a much higher percentage of known books in the packs. But like I said, it was as simple as trying to find one with at least 2 issues that looked interesting or intrigued me. So Turok Dinosaur Hunter number 1? No, really. There were a few that had that on the cover. Nope. Deathmate? You have got to be kidding me. And there were some that had, you know, as the frontispiece, as the main selling point, books from various free comic book days. And nope. That is one thing I always leave behind in the quarter bins, so no free comic book day books. TV tie-ins for shows I didn't like, I passed on those too. So the one I settled on one side I can see Catwoman number 36 from 2004, the Ed Brubaker run. It's part 7 of 8 of War Games Act 3. So there's a chance that nothing much happens in this issue, being the penultimate part of an arc, or that stuff happens that I won't have any context for, not having the rest of the storyline, but at least it's a mainstream, legitimate comic book. On the other side is an issue of Princeless from Action Lab, which is a series I've heard good things about. Actually, as I look at this, it does appear to be from a series called Princeless Be Yourself. It's issue 4 of that. So that may be a spinoff or a side story, or maybe that's just the name of the arc. It's a little hard to tell. But again, it's a series I have heard good things about. And the risk you run is that these are the 2 books that are, you know, the sales pieces, that the other 8 probably have lower profiles, lower popularities, that sort of thing. But we'll see. So now I'm going to pause the recording to open up the pack. All right, we do in fact have 10 comics here, and there are no duplicates. So that part of the cover copy is accurate. Now, they did promise that these would be a $20 value. These 10 books do have a combined cover price of $26.46. So 3 for 3 on the marketing. I'm not going to say what specific books are in here. You'll have to listen to the rest of the episode to learn that. But I will say this. The pack had the 1 DC that was visible, 2 Marvels, and 7 Indies. Books from as far back as 1986 all the way up to 2017. And at least 1 book from every decade in between. So if nothing else, they did a good job with the grab bag aspect of packing these comics up. It is a diverse bunch of issues. I will say that. Now, I've arranged these books in alphabetical order, and that's how I'm going to go through these. Again, stealing from the Ben Avery approach, I'm going to pause the recording here, read the first book, and come back and talk about it. And that's going to be the process. One book at a time, just a few minutes each. And first up will be The Bionic Man, number 6, from Dynamite, from 2012. I'll be back in a few seconds to talk to you about it. Before I talk too much about this issue of The Bionic Man, I do want to acknowledge that the man behind this book, Kevin Smith, has recently suffered a major cardiac event, and to the best of my knowledge, he may still be in the hospital as I record this. I'm sure there are many fans of his among the listenership, and we certainly wish him well. This series of The Bionic Man ran 26 issues from 2011 to 2013, and Smith's connection to it is that the series is an adaptation of an unproduced 1998 screenplay for a $6 million man film that was designed as a reboot of the original TV show updating the adventures of Steve Austin to the then modern days of the late 90s. For the comic, Phil Hester's scripts then update story details and plot points for the 2010s. And what we have in this one is Austin, pretty early in his career, discovering that there was a bionic man created before him. Austin is to track him down and neutralize him. But this other guy, Hull, knows that Steve is coming and awaits him. And they have a nice Darth Vader and Luke moment, where Hull is trying to convince Austin that they are the next step in evolution, and that together they can work to create a better world for bionics like them. And all it will take is killing a few billion humans and converting most of the rest to bionics. And like most crazy evil geniuses, he just happens to envision himself as the ruler of this new and improved world, with Austin by his side, of course. Steve, because he's a hero, refuses, and we end the issue with Austin still captured and a 20-minute countdown ready to start. That countdown is to the destruction of the base, which Hull is ready to evacuate, leaving Austin behind to be blown up real good. Now, this is not the most original plot, and Hull even calls that out at what point himself, saying, "I know, I watch a lot of movies." And I guess that's a clever way to hang a lantern on the weaknesses in the plot. And I don't mean the plotting of the comic book or the proposed movie. I mean the evil plot designed by the evil mastermind. Maybe we're just supposed to think that he's not as smart as he thinks he is. And we get the requisite name checks that you'd expect. Jamie, Oscar, the OSI. So it hits all of those nostalgia buttons for me. There was a bit more exposition than was needed, but that may be a remnant of this starting as a movie script. In a movie, you can give that exposition with action, with activity happening in the background, using visuals and editing and so on to keep that exposition from sounding like just exposition. But in a series of still panels, these long speeches, whether they're explaining Austin's mission or it's Hull explaining his background, whatever, those can become a bit tiresome. Comic book scripts, from what I understand, listening to writers, is all about cut, cut, cut. The fewest words possible to convey the point, that's the point. So a few quibbles here and there, but not a bad issue, especially being part of a serialized, ongoing story. It's not a great issue by any means, but not too bad a way to start a grab bag, to be honest. Next up, after a very short break, I'll talk about one of the NCAP comics, one of the selling points for this pack, Catwoman, 36 from DC Comics, cover dated December 2004. The description of the War Games storyline, according to Comic Book DB, is this. A citywide gang war has been set off by the Batman protocols once they've fallen into the wrong hands. The hands of Spoiler. Can Batman and family save Gotham from devolving into a slum of violence, or will the events have greater consequences for them all. And Catwoman 36 takes place very near the end of this storyline, being the 24th part of the 27-parter. And like I said, that can be a recipe for not much happening. It's possible in a case like this that a book could exist simply as filler to get us to the required ending. But that is not the case here at all. We do jump into the middle of that long-going, ongoing story, The City on Fire and all that. Catwoman goes up against Philo Zeiss, who I admit on first appearance looked like he might be related to Nick Fury. They banter a lot, fight a lot. She ends up victorious, but the city is still a mess. And when she calls Oracle to get some help, she doesn't get an answer. And that's because in addition to this long, ongoing War Games arc, there's a nice little contained plot line in this issue, and that's important to have when you're balancing serialized and episodic forms of storytelling. In this specific issue, the episodic arc that's happening is Black Mask is leading a gang of thugs to storm the Batcave, the location of which he has recently discovered. Well, sort of, because he has discovered the location of something Bat-related, but that is in fact the location of Oracle's watchtower. Barbara sets off some traps, and a bunch of the intruders die, but Black Mask does get in. And remember, he is expecting to find Batman in a Batcave, so he is quite confused by Barbara in her chair, and just asks her, "Who are you supposed to be, girl? The Bat Secretary?" Okay, no, Stella would not think that's funny, but I have to admit, I thought that was pretty funny. I've talked about this other aspect before, but I dig the Catwoman-Batman relationship, whether it's an actual romance or just a flirty, hard to pin down exactly what's going on, something or another. And I think that's where they are in this era. She's definitely part of the team, although I'm not sure that she is always going to meet the definition of hero. Not sure about that. And this isn't my favorite version of her costume. The whip, black leather, goggles, and cat ears. I do like the goggles, to be honest. And to give Paul Gulacy credit, he does draw the costume very well. Let's just say that the irredeemable Shag is probably a fan. All in all, not a bad comic book issue. Brubaker just knows how to write comic book stories, and he did another pretty good job here. Again, a nice balance between being part 24 of a 27-part mega arc, pushing that story forward enough. Batman and the GCPD are involved in the ongoing story, and next issue that picks up, I'm sure. But it also gives a nice Catwoman element, a nice Oracle story with a little cliffhanger. What I was looking for was stuff to happen, because I'm not sure stuff would happen. But it did, definitely. All right, good. Next up, another mainstream book from Marvel, from the New Universe line, to be precise. Pause the recording, and when I come back, I'll talk about Codename Spitfire, number 11, from August 1987. When the New Universe came out, I bought a bunch of those books. My recollection is that I ended up owning every issue of Justice and Night Mask and Mark Hazard Merc, as well as certain other issues from other of the titles like DP7 and Psi-Force. There were some good books in the line, and there was also Kickers Inc. Codename Spitfire began life as Spitfire and the Troubleshooters for the first 9 issues, before putting out the last 4 with this title. So this issue is pretty late in the run, issue 11 out of 13. I can't recall if I stuck with the title when it changed names, but I suspect that I may have used that as a jumping off point. So I may have read this one as a kid, but I don't think so. In terms of the issue itself, let me focus on 2 phrases that are in this book, one at the beginning and one at the end. And sort of focus on those. The first words I saw on the bottom of the first page were Fabian Nicieza, writer. And I know that he's popular. His line for signings at last year's Baltimore Comic Con was way longer than the line for Jim Starlin or James Tynion or Giffen and DeMatteis. So my tastes do not always line up with general comic book popularity. But I'm not really a fan. Obviously, he was a major force at Marvel in the early to mid-90s, which is an era where I don't think Marvel was putting out its best work. So I confess, I saw his name, and it worried me a bit. Now, this is literally the second book on Nicieza's comic book DB page, and there's a sense of the young, hungry writer here. It's not just a better story than I expected, but it was actually a pretty good story. And one of the things that helped was another phrase that I like to see when I'm picking up random books from cheap bins or when I'm going through grab bags of random comics to read. And those are the two words, the end. A cheap comic book is way more attractive to me if it says that on the last page, as opposed to the end's mortal enemy, to be continued. And this issue ends with the end. There is story that happened before. There's been a failed mission in Nicaragua. That does have consequences for this issue, but you didn't need to read that to read this. Also, there's story in the next issues. We're promised that our team will face political fallout from their actions in this issue. But here, in these 22 pages, we get a full story, a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that matters. Basically, the failed mission from last issue left a man behind. But political pressures on the Spitfire team are not allowing them to rescue their man. So the injured pilot of the big robot suit, Jenny Swenson, talks the chief engineer, Ann Policino, into letting her climb back into the still damaged Spitfire suit for a rogue rescue mission. And that mission is both dramatic and successful. But Roth, the man in command, is being yelled at by politicians in the Pentagon for his people disobeying orders. They were not supposed to rescue the man. And he recognizes that the entire program has been put in jeopardy. Now again, maybe it was low expectations, I don't know. But I quite enjoyed this story. Maybe it was having politicians and military leaders act the way politicians and military leaders should act, which is not always the way in fiction. Often, the hotshot who disobeys orders to attempt a rescue, especially if that mission is successful, is lauded and the chain of command casually ignores all of the disobeyed orders. But in real life, that's not going to happen. So I like that in this case, the mission itself was a success, but there certainly will be consequences to both Swenson and to the entire team. So I kind of like that. And this was adventurous. This was fun. This was a standalone within a larger context, a full chapter of a story. Good on you, Fabian Nicieza. I'm not going to lie. As far as this grab bag goes, and remember, we're simply going in alphabetical order. But so far, so good. Which leads us from one of the two Marvel books in this pack to the other Marvel book in the pack. So after another little break, we'll be back to talk about Daredevil 354, cover dated July 1996. Daredevil 354 is a classic example of the Marvel team-up approach, in this case between Daredevil and your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. At one point, Spider-Man even calls out that Marvel trope, saying he's just not in the mood to fight with Daredevil before their inevitable, eventual team-up. But the issue starts with Matt Murdock, attorney at law. He and Foggy are considering joining Rosalind Sharpe's new law firm and both of those lawyers go out on dates, Foggy with Liz Osborne and Matt with Karen, with her short-haired 90s look. Karen makes a range of devil-themed food jokes at their date, suggesting deviled eggs, deviled food cake, shrimp Diablo. That was actually all pretty funny. The villain called Hyde is in the newspaper, and they talk a bit about him, Matt saying he's the closest thing to pure evil he's ever seen. And as they're eating and chatting, Ben Urich and Pete Parker stop by to say hello. And then the weirdest thing happens. Spider-Man flies right by, confusing Matt very much because he knows the secret. There's a funny moment when he has to make off to change to Daredevil, and each of the other people there, Peter, Urich, and Karen, because they each think they're the only person who knows, so they all cover for Matt with the other ones. Then actual Peter Parker, Spidey, shows up and explains to Daredevil the basic outline of the Clone Saga. And as they're having some quality bonding time hanging out on a building, they both sense, at the same time, a shotgun. And at the other end is the villain called the Shooter, which they both agree is not much of a name, and they quibble over Shooter's contention that Kingpin is a villain for Daredevil, not Spider-Man. Everyone forgets that I made that big butterball, Spidey laments. Well, they beat this low-end palooka, and then Daredevil heads off to his new job at the new firm, and we learn that Matt Murdock's first client that he has to defend is Hyde. I didn't mention that Carl Kiesel wrote this, and that helped it not fall too far into 90s tropes, and the humor really helped me enjoy this. Certainly knowing the characters already, not from this run or this version or this era even, but knowing who Pete and Ben and Matt and Foggy and Karen are, all of that helped me understand what was going on in this one. There was a prior understanding of the relationships that I could sort of lay this story over, and all that helped me understand what was going on in this one, again, at that character level. And even though there was a character-based cliffhanger, Matt having to defend Hyde, but as it's been pretty clear as I sort of thought about this, I really appreciate that this issue tells a complete story. I've mentioned that in other parts of this episode already. So even if there are to-be-continued aspects of the ongoing narrative, it also helps for at least one part of the story, preferably the action part of the story, the team-up to defeat the Shooter. At least that had a conclusion. So pretty decent read, actually. I'm going to say surprisingly satisfying. Good job, Carl Kiesel. And that is the end of the big two books for this episode, for better or worse. It'll be interesting to see how I deal with books and characters I'm far less familiar with. Like I said before, that certainly helped me enjoy this one as much as I did. But a lot of the books that are upcoming don't have that built-in advantage of having, just through cultural osmosis and being a comic book geek in general, watching Netflix series and movies and other comic books with these characters. And that's a situation that a lot of the upcoming books don't share. And that just worked out this way. Remember, I put these issues together alphabetically, so it's by pure coincidence that we're off solely, completely to the world of the independents now. So next, after another little old short break, we'll look at a Dynamite book from 2014, The Flash Gordon, 40-page holiday special. Okay, to be fair, I do know a little bit about Flash Gordon. But that being said, what I know about Flash Gordon is pretty much limited to Flash himself, Ming, Sam Jones's hair, and the music of Queen. So this comic book still broadly falls into the category of, I don't know a lot of these people. Certainly not in their comic book versions, and certainly not in these comic book versions. So unlike the Spider-Man issue I just talked about, I have only the most tenuous connections to the characters in the book, But on the other hand, it's a holiday special. So there are things there that I could latch onto for context. And this is an anthology book, three different stories. And similar to the DC Rebirth holiday special that Em and I covered a year or so back, this was a holiday special in the truest sense, as the three stories in here covered Christmas, Hanukkah, and New Year's. The Flash Gordon story, the eight-pager about Christmas, or at least one planet's version of Christmas, was actually what I thought was the weakest story. I very much enjoyed the Hanukkah story, Wonders and Salvations, featuring a character I did not know, Jurg the Beastman. This was the longest of the three stories, 14 pages. Actually, don't want to go into details on this story too much, why I like it so much, because as soon as I finished this issue, it went directly onto the darkness to light pile. So Christmas season 2018, maybe 2019, I really hope Em and I cover this story. I really liked it. The New Year story featuring Dale Arden was also pretty fun. It actually takes place over three consecutive New Years, each one bad in its own way, but they do seem to get progressively worse. Again, characters I didn't know, or at least know well, but situations and scenarios that I understood, and overall pretty solid. But that is the problem with anthology books, and maybe it's why they don't seem to sell very well, at least over here in the U.S. I think that 2000 AD is still a monster in the U.K., even though they lost, was it Andy Leyland or Mark Adams? I can't remember now, but one of those U.K. podcasters I listened to dropped 2000 AD when it went to color. Pretty sure it was Mark Adams now, because I think I remember one of the girls, or maybe both, expressing their lack of interest in black and white comics, that being the source of that conversation. But with that possibly as an exception, 2000 AD across the pond, anthology comics tend to not do well. Again, that's a U.S.-centric approach. And I think part of it, at least I can say it for myself, that there's a built-in problem, that you're not going to like every story the same. So you're going to be including a couple of stories you're not going to like as much. And especially, you know, I'm going to go there. At the prices of modern comics, I wouldn't want to pay for one or two stories in an issue that I'm less than enthralled with. Now, this one in specific, 40 pages, 30 pages of content, and the longest story, the 14-pager, I liked quite a bit. As I said, I'm going to save this issue for future possible coverage of that story. But remember that I said that this whole grab bag was priced at Ollie's at $5.99. This episode is about deciding whether it's worth that blind risk of paying $5.99 for these 10 books that you're not going to know. Well, this one issue, this Flash Gordon holiday special, had a cover price of $5.99. So nearly $6 for 10 books, hoping that I'll like a majority of them, that's one thing. $6 for 30 pages of content, only 14 pages of which I really, really like, just not worth it. You know, since I'm actually going to keep this book, like I said, maybe I can think of this whole grab bag scenario as buy one, get nine free. Like, I paid full price for this holiday special that I'm going to keep, and everything else is a freebie. Maybe that's one way to think about it. Sometimes we geeks just have to overthink everything, don't we? That gets us to the halfway point of the grab bag, by the way. And after another little break, we'll take a look at a book from Action Lab, Nutmeg number 5. I read the book Brave Chef Brianna last year, a four-issue series focusing on cooking and running a restaurant for aliens. After I talked about that on a comics reading journal, I think it was Ed Moore who lamented the lack of comic books about cooking. Well, here's another. And I'm not saying right now whether I liked this issue or not, but this is by far the worst fit I've run across so far in the grab bag. Yes, this comic was published one issue at a time, but this is the type of comic designed for the OGN treatment. It's just a comic that's not intended to be new reader friendly. The old idea that any issue could be someone's first issue is still followed pretty closely by Marvel and DC, making sure that some attempt to explain what's gone on before is part of the comics. In Marvel's case, that's often a literal what's gone before page. While in DC, that's with some exposition or some other writing technique, usually in the first couple of pages of the story. But this book doesn't do that. It's an ongoing, serialized storyline, and there's no getting around that. It is designed to be read in order. The notion that issue 5 might be someone's first issue, probably not part of their plan. This is a teen girl story, although written by a male, I will point out. And that by itself, being targeted to that demo, is not a problem for me. I've read plenty of YA novels and comics aimed at the teen girl demographic. Like I said above, I really liked Brave Chef Brianna as an example. And if you've read Lumberjanes, this is, I would maybe think of this book as Lumberjanes meets Brave Chef Brianna, possibly. So we have two BFF leads who've gotten over their heads in some sort of cupcake baking war. In this issue, they sneak into a rival's kitchen and bake their secret recipes. But one of the BFFs is allergic to nutmeg and sort of trips out on it, like maybe it was an edible of a different kind. There were some compelling aspects to this issue, and I'm pretty sure some of these are on the Hoopla digital app. So it wouldn't surprise me if I ended up reading more of Nutmeg, which is kind of weird because as a standalone, as a single issue in a grab bag, it really didn't work. So despite having almost no idea what was actually happening here, this issue did make me interested enough in finding out what happened before this issue. So weirdly enough, sort of a failure, but sort of a success as well. I'm very confused by my reaction to this issue. Now, I don't want to get too introspective here, so I'm going to move on to the next book. And that's an Image book from their Skybound imprint, which means Robert Kirkman. So after a brief musical interlude, we'll get to Outcast, number 25. I am certain I have seen this book before. This was a special issue, number 25, and Image priced it at 25 cents. So when I saw that a year or so back whenever, it caught my eye. 25 cent comics, you know, I try to keep track of those. And it was Kirkman, and I've read a bunch of Walking Dead and a decent amount of Invincible, and enjoyed them enough. But when I saw this one flip through it, nothing about it jumped out at me. So I have a weird, awkward situation here. A book I've passed over in the quarter bins, but I have to judge here whether it's worth 60 cents. So this one does have a high bar to cross. And similar to the prior book, Nutmeg, this issue is merely one short chapter in the midst of a long story arc. I had no idea what was happening, who the characters were, etc. And so what I'm sure was a dramatic cliffhanger slash reveal at the end of the issue, a literal I'm your father moment, that was pretty much lost on me, like totally lost on me. I mean, I get the supernatural thriller stuff, the demon possession, the clergyman, but that's at the very most basic surface level reading. Any intricacy there was in terms of relationships and characters, I didn't get it, because this issue didn't give me anything to get. So like I said, I'm bringing in some baggage to this issue, having looked at it in cheap bins, and deciding that it wasn't worth 25 cents. And I'll be honest, reading this issue pretty much confirmed that original assessment. I'm not saying this isn't a good title, or a good series. I haven't heard anything about the series on Cinemax. But just based on this one issue of the comic, let's just say I'm going to read some more Nutmeg before I read any more Outcast. Next up is the other NCAP book, the other one that helped talk me into buying this specific pack of Grab Bag comics. So a little more music, and then we'll talk about Princeless, Be Yourself, number 4. Like Nutmeg, this is another title that operates on the graphic novel model much more than it does on the single issue business model. As a matter of fact, there is not an ongoing book titled Princeless. They've released about 6 or 7 volumes of trades, all with a specific subtitle. This one is Princeless, Be Yourself. And all of these volumes usually run 4 or 5 issues, with the occasional one-shot special thrown in. I think this may be one possible model for the future of comic book publishing, just getting rid of the monthlies altogether, with regular releases of graphic novels every 6 months or so, under an ongoing title, each with a separate subtitle. This is the way the regular world of prose publishing works. Each of the novels in, say, the Spencer series by Robert B. Parker or Kathy Reich's Bones novels, each novel has a separate title, and each one starts on page 1. Yes, there is an order they were written in, an order in which the events occur in. Sometimes that's the same, sometimes it's not. But that's the way books work. That's the way novel series work. It's not one ongoing story, although they can be read that way. Those are series of separate novels. And I think that may be the way that some comic books end up going. Especially for younger readers, I think. I have absolutely no data to back this assertion up, but I would imagine that the median age of a floppy purchaser is much higher than the median age of trade waiters, or trade borrowers from libraries, or trade readers via digital apps like Hoopla. And maybe that starts here, with the smaller companies like Action Lab, and with titles focused on younger readers, and let's be honest, female readers. Which brings us to Princeless, Be Yourself, number 4, which does wrap up the Be Yourself arc, and that makes this a much more readable issue than the average miscellaneous book from the middle of a long run of a superhero comic. And it was pretty good. This is totally a girl's story in the sense that the main characters are female. Many of the side characters are as well, and the love interest is a fella. What matters in the story is the action of the females, their relationships, their opinions, their POVs. And also, there were vampires, and dragons, and ogres, all sorts of fun stuff. The art is action-packed and dramatic, and all of those fantasy elements that I mentioned are all well-designed and well-carried out. But this one didn't really appeal to me overwhelmingly. It's not necessarily the kind of story that I seek out for whatever reason, but I recognize that it's pretty good. It's put together very well. And I think I can see why the title is both an award winner and pretty popular. And then after this musical break, we jump back in time to 1990 to a comic book based on one of my favorite cartoons of all time. From Now Comics, we'll be looking at Speed Racer, number 29. Go, Speed Racer, go, Speed Racer, go, Speed Racer, go! Oh, wait, are you guys back? In Japan, there is an entire genre of sports manga. But in the U.S., sports comics basically don't exist. DC has tried championship sports and strange sports, but they never last long, and to be honest, some of the stories aren't that good. The closest Marvel ever got was X-Men Downtime issues. because the less said about NFL Super Pro and Kickers Incorporated, the better. I wonder if this is a cultural U.S. thing, a geeks versus jocks thing. And then there's the conflation of sports fan and jock. I don't know if I am in the minority here, but it certainly feels like I'm in the minority here by being an avid fan of sports and also a comic book geek. At least in the online groups I'm a part of, there's a lot more of the condescending, "this is about sports ball" comments than anything else when the subject of sports comes up. Yes, there is a Two True Freaks Fantasy Football League that I've been a part of the last few years, but it seems like every other team there is managed by a Jack and Eddie, so I don't know if that counts. But my impression is certainly that the intersection of sports fans and comic book fans is pretty narrow. I do need to give a shout out here to Tom Panarees, who has done a number of sports episodes on Pop Culture Affidavit. I think Paul Spataro guested on one. So I'm not trying to say I'm the only sports fan comic book podcaster. Again, it just seems like there aren't a lot of us. But however wide or narrow that part of the Venn diagram is, I am in it. And my biggest single fandom among sports actually confuses my comic book friends quite a bit whenever I post about it, because it is a fandom of a North London soccer club that shares a name with a comic book character. Arsenal. As of this recording, I'm just barely getting caught up on all the TV shows that I DVR'd during the 18 days of the 2018 South Korea Winter Olympics, because I spent just about every waking hour during those 18 days watching the Winter Olympics. Everything else got put on hold. Matter of fact, my first true geekiness was for baseball statistics, including creating new player cards for the Avalon Hill Status Pro baseball game for players they had not included, or for all-time great teams, so I could play team versus team, 27 Yankees versus 54 Indians, newer players whose careers hadn't completed by the time the game was published. I spent more time with the Baseball Encyclopedia than any other book between the ages of, 8 to 18 or something. I was totally not a jock, never have been. But that has nothing to do with me being a sports geek. Or to put it more specifically, with my geeky origins being very much informed by sports fandom. Not a jock, but a fan. Don't conflate the two. Feel free to hate jocks, but don't hate sports fans. They aren't the same people. And the other big contributor to my general state of geekiness? Animated cartoons, including Speed Racer. Loved, loved, loved this show. And of course, it's Japanese, because they seem to have a much different cultural understanding about sports and melodrama and geekiness. In this specific issue, we have an older racer looking for his 100th career victory before he retires. Speed and his team partnering with a businessman as a sponsor to help supply the guys with better mechanics and an improved Mach 5. But at what price? And we also have the evil Alpha racing team who want to injure, or worse, Speed on the track. And if that means running him into a wall, or actually shooting out his tires from the stands, they'll do it. As has been sort of an ongoing theme in this episode, when you pick up a random issue in the middle of a run, Daredevil 354, Outcast 25, Nutmeg 5, or Speed Racer 29, you don't need every part of the story to be buttoned up. You can hang off a cliff or two at the end, but it's a way more satisfying of a read if a thing, or a thing or two, is wrapped up within each issue. That combination of episodic and serialized is a very tough balance to maintain, no doubt. A lot of TV shows and comic books do it quite poorly, but some have done it pretty well. Daredevil 354 did it well. Codename Spitfire 11 did it well. And Speed Racer 29 does it well. The old retired racer storyline has a definite resolution in this issue. The evil Alpha Racing Team has some resolution, although we know that they will be ongoing thorns in the side. And the new sponsor businessman story ends with a dramatic bit, a cliffhanger, if you will. And all of that combined, not for a great comic book, I'm not going to make that claim, but for a very satisfying comic book, I'm definitely saying that. Next up, or should I say last up, is another one from many decades back, Tales of Terror, number 5, from Eclipse Comics, March 1986. What we have here is another anthology mag, and as we've already talked about this episode, that can be a shaky proposition. But if you're going to do an anthology book, one way to do it is to start the book out with a Chuck Dixon story. That is always a good start, because that's what this one does. And it's a pretty good Twilight Zone type of story about a guy who runs an illegal auto chop shop, only to find himself as the victim of a human parts chop shop, if you know what I'm saying. Good story, nicely creepy, and a the bad guy gets it ending. Like I said, after this, I had high hopes for the anthology, but the problem with anthology books, as we said earlier, is that the other stories aren't going to hold up against the great stories, or even the very good stories, or maybe even just the good stories. Because we follow up that really nice Chuck Dixon tale with two pretty bland ones. One about monsters lurking in a farmer's field, and one about a doll and her band of evil doll conspirators. Meh. The last story, which is basically an anti-drunk driving PSA, was written by Tom Field and drawn and lettered by Lee Weeks. The story itself is fine, but what makes it more interesting as a piece is the letters page, which is on the page opposite the last page of that last story. Evidently, Eclipse had run some anti-drunk driving PSAs as advertisements the year before, and the company got a letter about that. A letter actually complaining about them. This guy, with his whole name and address printed, but I'll just use his first name, Mark. Mark explains his system of driving drunk successfully, and that it's only a cabal of lawyers, police officers, mad, and politicians who make a big deal about the issue of drunk driving. Remember, 1986. The legendary Eclipse editor, Cat Ironwood, responded a bit, and then gave half the letters page to the writer of the drunk driving story, Tom Field, to address the issue. And he tells a harrowing story about his good friend from high school, Lee Weeks, the artist of the story, who went on to have a very long career in comics. Anyway, Weeks was nearly killed by a drunk driver, lost a kidney, his spleen, and his potential college football scholarships. The writer talks about his collaborations with Weeks and how ironic and ultimately it fitting it was that their first professional work, which is this story, was on a topic that was so personal to these two good friends. And let that be a lesson to you all. No, not a lesson about drunk driving, because that's not a lesson you guys probably need. You know it's a bad idea. The lesson I'm referring to when I say let that be a lesson is that one of the great advantages of reading individual comics issues compared to trade paperbacks or digital versions are the ads and of course, the letter pages. This letter page was a gem and added so much context to that last story. Was this a great issue? No. Was it a good first story and a fascinating last story because of the letter page? Yes. Am I glad I read it? Definitely. And that is all 10 books. Let me take one final musical break, and then we'll come back for a summary of my feelings on the issues on Ollie's and on Grab Bags. First things first, the music in this episode was a piece by Bach with an unpronounceable Germanic title from the album Bach Works for Trumpet and Organ by Marie-Claire Alain and Guy Touvron. Just wanted to make sure I mentioned that. Also, over the few days it took me to record this episode, I did follow up with Christopher J. Warden. I talked to him about his haul, about his mega haul from Ollie's. And I guess it's mega hauls, plural. Now, Christopher's job involves travel, and he managed to hit a number of Ollie's locations in a number of cities in a number of states across the upper Midwest. I asked him to summarize his purchases, as well as what his favorite or least expected purchase was, as well as what he thought the best deal was that he got. Overall, he purchased 33 showcases, 48 trade paperbacks, 22 hardcover trades, 10 archives, an omnibus, and about 5 other miscellaneous books. Christopher's favorites included the Blue Beetle showcase, Legion of Superheroes The Curse hardcover, and the Great Disaster showcase. Now, that last one intrigued me, and I'm going to keep my eyes out for it. The Great Disaster was the in-continuity, semi-official future for the DCU up until the pre-crisis era. I read some of the Atomic Knights stories in 1970s reprint books and would be interested in having this showcase. So I'm going to go back to the Ollie's near me one more trip around the horn to see if I missed that or missed anything else. In terms of the best deal that he got, Christopher said, it was the $75 cover-priced Just Imagine If Stan Lee omnibus. He got it for $12.99. Impressive, Chris. Impressive. So definitely, if you are a DC fan, and if there is an Ollie's bargain outlet anywhere near you, check it out before they're all gone. This was a one-time purchase deal with DC, so literally, once these trades and showcases and other items are gone, they are gone. But remember, even if those showcases and DC out-of-print books get sold out, Ollie's will continue to have grab bags. And maybe that's the lesson of this whole episode. Ollie's, go for the cheap DC stuff, stay for the grab bags. Now let's recap this specific grab bag. Of the 10 issues, I enjoyed more of them than I did not enjoy. Let's start there. One of them I'm keeping for future podcast coverage. One of them spurred me on to investigate the title more, and more than a few piqued my interest towards picking up more if I ever see them for cheap. I'm looking at you, Speed Racer. Personally, I'm not going to run out and buy another 10-pack for $6. Just as a way to pass the time. As I record this, tomorrow is my LCS's annual anniversary sale, at which, in addition to other bargain and saving opportunities, the dollar books are 3 for $1, and the quarter books are a dime. So I imagine I'll be walking out of there with a 10-pack for $1, not $6, maybe more than one such 10-pack, and it'll be books that I've selected. So this is a good deal, these grab bags at Ollie's, better than most of the grab bag deals I've seen recently. I think Ben Avery's books, the ones that he talks about over on Comic Book Time Machine, usually run a buck or so per book, something like three comics for $3 or four comics for $5, somewhere in that range. So 10 comics for $6 is a pretty good deal if you just want to take a chance at the randomness of what will be in there. But most of you are not nearly as cheap as me, so that may appeal to you more. And I do hope that this grab bag episode gave you some insight into what these particular grab bags may contain, the range of books, the type of books that you might get. Now, if you do take the plunge and decide to spend your $6 on 10 books from Ollie's, shoot me an email and let me know what you got and if you're satisfied. And certainly, if you have any comments on any of the 10 issues that I covered here, more generally, any of these titles, let me know what you think. And if you're one of the lucky ones with an Ollie's nearby and made a few great purchases, it doesn't have to be on the massive scale of Christopher J. Warden, but whatever you bought, let me know. This network, as you know, is all about the bargains. Those emails can be sent to relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or comments can be left on the Facebook post or the blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening.